Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Hey, Mike. Happy Friday, and welcome to another edition of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast.
Happy Friday, Tim. Always good to be talking national security issues with you on a Friday. I think today we're going to talk about something that I know we've hinted at, I think, in other podcasts in terms of different types of intelligence information. Today, we want to talk about open source intelligence to be distinguished from human intelligence, right? Or signals intelligence, all those classic terms of the trade that you know more about than I do. But I find open source intelligence to be very, very exciting because, at least from what I've been seeing, I think this is, you know, out there both from government and industry speakers, the amount of data that's at our fingertips is far beyond what we would have had 10, 20 years ago. And the open source aspect that I find exciting is it's not the purview of just governments, like it's out there everywhere. But before I go all the way down about how excited I am about the availability of open source intelligence, can you give the listeners a little background about why that's different than the other types of intelligence?
Yep. So the thing that distinguishes open source intelligence from most of the products that come out of the intelligence community is that they are unclassified. You know, it is information that is publicly available, whether it is news information, whether it's information that's available through public databases, housing, property registrations, social media. You know, there's an almost limitless amount of data that is flowing around freely and available to anybody at this point. That distinguishes from a lot of the work that the intelligence community does, which involves essentially going and, you know, acquiring information through clandestine means, you know, either stealing it or plucking it from the airwaves using satellites and other technical measures. It is extremely exciting. It is an area that has been growing in importance within the IC, the intelligence community, and it's one that an increasing number of current and former intelligence officials think needs to be augmented in terms of its prominence and independence within the community.
So that's very interesting. You know, I think there's a lot of proponents for it. Could you comment on, you know, and I guess this is why I mentioned sort of I feel like there's more of it available now, but that's maybe just data generally. How historically has the IC looked at open source intelligence? I know there was like an open source intelligence center like years ago, but I kind of, you know, so they've looked at it and there's now we're here in the present, but how was the IC viewed open source intelligence historically versus where we are now?
So open source, you know, historically, I think going back to the 1950s and 60s, CIA officers in Hong Kong used to buy fish and other meat at the markets in Hong Kong because it was wrapped in newspapers, many of which came from the mainland. And so it was a way of acquiring open source intelligence. And reading newspapers, looking at journals and other publications, you know, books, that's been going on for decades as part of, you know, intelligence writ large, whether it's been performed by the intelligence agencies themselves or whether the State Department or another part of the government's been doing it. What has changed over the last 20 years or so is just the sheer volume of information that's flowing out there. Photographs, you know, that people take. I first encountered this story, I guess, in Syria in 2015 and 16. When people were trying to determine sort of the prevalence of Russian troops there, they were able to do a lot of this work by looking at Facebook and other social media posts that Russian troops were posting, geolocating the pictures and looking at unit patches and other information. So there's that. There's all kinds of open databases that collect personal data, We're very worried, you know, about the government collecting data on us, but all kinds of credit agencies and banks and other commercial enterprises are collecting data on all of us all the time. And that data is available for sale. And you can be a foreign government and buy that data. You know, at this point, there is an enormous amount of information about all of us that is available to anybody who wants it. There's also an enormous amount of information available about work that gets done, whether it's at university labs, whether it's within the military itself, or at a whole host of other facilities. There's more information about that than has ever been available before. And that's out there for anybody who wants it to take and analyze.
I'm put in mind of things like Dun & Bradstreet's, which I think they originally were a mercantile information entity, you know, in the 1800s, and they had like correspondence everywhere. It would kind of a different angle of what you mentioned with getting the newspapers, you know, from China. You'd have someone out there who would be getting data on shipping and commerce, not as a news reporter for this mercantile agency, which, as I recall, that, you know, you subscribe to this. Like, Dun & Bradstreet didn't make that stuff free. You had to sort of be a subscriber to that. And to a lot of the examples you just gave now, I think we have a lot of that today too, where it's companies have gone out and vacuumed up data and then they can make it available to you all, you know, on a subscription basis or a fee. Some of that is stuff that wouldn't necessarily have been accessible to non-government entities. Like, imagery is a good example. Everyone's using Google Maps nowadays, and you go back far enough and, you know, commercial satellite imagery was just not a thing you got on the internet. Like, that was not available. There's apps that, you know, do the mapping. There's Trails apps, like all that's out there. But that example, I guess that's free as opposed to paying on a subscription basis. Yeah, I guess that's another angle that maybe we should talk about sort of is, you know, for open source intelligence, sort of what's out there that's maybe freely available that the IC can take advantage of, like the rest of us. And then others might be stuff you have to pay for. And right. And that's just, to me, that's almost kind of like a normal commercial contract. It would just be the IC community is another consumer and they subscribe to these things and they get that. I believe, but I like your thoughts on this too, that's probably more cost effective for, you know, both our government and others to go, well, let's just get the data that a company's already gathered rather than have to go out and gather it all ourselves. But then I guess the next question will be, at what point do you sort of put your analytical lens on and view that, right? It's the quality of the data, the quality of the source and who the folks are they're getting it from. I can't imagine there isn't some analytical work that has to be done on the government side when they get it, or maybe there's really great products out there that these companies offer, which is essentially give you a commercially available version of the president's daily brief and you just subscribe to it. I mean, I think some of that might be there, actually.
All right, there's a lot to unpack there. Let's start with maybe some of the types of data that, look, anything, you know, Twitter, other social media, right? There's all kinds of information that I was actually able to glean by following a few well-curated Twitter sites during the early weeks and months of the Ukraine war. There's all kinds of Substacks and other open source analysis pieces that are out there now that look at things like Chinese government documents and will sort of crowdsource translate them and then even provide rudimentary analysis. And that's something that, you know, heretofore was the province of governments and universities, and it took a long time. For instance, the Chinese National People's Congress enacted a new counter-espionage law, and we'll probably talk about that at some point in a future episode, but there was a crowdsourced translation of that law that was, you know, up on the web within about 24 to 48 hours, and is sort of constantly being tweaked as different experts in Chinese language and law are sort of adding their commentary. So that's the one thing. The second thing, I do want to talk about the imagery, because the imagery has been like a big game changer, and you really saw it come to the fore in Ukraine, where before, during, and after the invasion, the U.S. government, journalists, and others have been putting out all kinds of overhead imagery. You'll remember that stalled 30-kilometer convoy that Maxar, I think, was following for days. You know, now there are a lot of commercial overhead images that have been running around the internet and on the news of sort of the Russian defensive fortifications that they've constructed in anticipation of the Ukrainian counteroffensive to come. So that's sort of an immediate imagery thing. But then there's something, another project that's been really interesting to me, and that's a thing called 38 North, which is a website that I think is run by the Stimson Center, or was at one point, I'm not sure if it still is, that looks at North Korea and especially looks at North Korea's weapons programs. And a lot of the work that they do is analyzing commercially available overhead imagery. And they've actually been responsible for finding and publicizing for the world a number of North Korean nuclear sites and weapon sites. And, you know, I've actually contributed sort of to the holistic understanding that we have of the North Korean weapons program. So that's sort of a concrete example right there. And then, you know, you brought up analysis. And that, I think, is really, that's the secret sauce here. And that's where professionalizing open source intelligence and sort of elevating it within the IC is so important, because the analytical tradecraft that the intelligence community brings to the analysis of clandestinely acquired information is the same level of analysis that they will bring to the analysis of openly acquired information. And that is a skill that is taught. It's a whole sort of directorate, if you will, within the CIA and elsewhere within the IC, and it's a whole career path. And so that, I think, is going to be the thing that really, that makes it useful is, you know, as with any data, getting the data is one thing, figuring out what it means is something altogether different.
So that reminded me, when we're talking about imagery, for example, is, and I've heard this said by others, former government and current government, that the plethora of information that's out there now makes it harder for intelligence agencies to actually conduct their business than it would have been 20 years ago. So this cuts both ways, right? Like, on the one hand, open source intelligence is great and something that could be used by governments to supplement, you know, the more classified information gathering. Because, as again, as you said, this is not sensitive or classified information. It's out there. Journalists have it, academics have it. Like, they're the ones gathering it and providing it. You flip that around, the Chinese weather balloon issue from a few months ago that we talked about on this podcast, as I recall, was first sort of, you know, advertised in the US from people's camera phones and on Twitter. And, like, you know, that was actually citizens finding this and it, like, blowing up on social media. And then it potentially maybe forced the US government to say something and deal with it, as opposed to perhaps, you know, other balloons like this or completely different ones in the past having come across the U.S. and no one ever having heard about it because the U.S. government strategically decided not to mention it. This kind of forced them into a decision-making posture. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that too, about, well, the other side of open source is things that we otherwise, whether it's the United States or allies or others, would have hoped to not have out in the public eye. Now it's possible more things will be discovered. And so how do you deal with the damage control of that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, sort of the whole notion of ubiquitous technical surveillance, for instance, has made human intelligence much more difficult for our operations officers out in the field, because they're constantly being monitored. And a lot of those cameras that are in foreign capitals and, you know, elsewhere, those aren't classified. You know, you'll remember a few years ago, the Israelis assassinated, I think it was a Hamas leader in the United Arab Emirates. And within days, the entire plot was unraveled, essentially using closed circuit TV footage from the airport and then inside the hotel elevators and the hallways. And, you know, it was pretty simple matter, actually, for the authorities over in the UAE to put together what had happened and to identify who it was. You see other organizations now in Europe and elsewhere sort of outing Russian intelligence officers embedded in embassies. You know, they don't always get it right, but essentially they're conducting their own sort of open source counterintelligence operations on their own and trying to sort out, you know, who's the spy. So it does. I mean, it makes it much more difficult. You know, people now everywhere you go are leaving sort of trails of what they call digital dust. And, you know, escaping from that is close to impossible. But at the same time, you're leaving that digital dust. So are your opponents. So everybody is sort of playing on the same, more constricted playing field, if you will.
I wanted to touch on a information safeguarding classification piece, because we previously did an episode on classified information. And as you've already mentioned, open source information, it really is supposed to be what's out there, what's either freely open that anyone can get, and then other things you might subscribe to or have to pay for. But it doesn't require security clearance for the open source analyst, if someone is just doing that job, to be able to view that stuff. But as we know, information the U.S. government or allied countries, you know, suck up and then may do something with, it's now under the possession and control of the U.S. government, and something else has been added or additional facts. But, you know, eventually a classification authority can classify it. What I find interesting about the open source approach is we've seen this a lot in the sort of middle ground of controlled unclassified information, or CUI, where information from the public or from industry goes to the government and then maybe comes back to industry or the public or whatever, and it's marked CUI. And if I'm a company, my answer would sort of be, if I saw that, is this is my information. I gave it to you, or I shared it with you. We had a subscription or a license or whatever, and now you've marked it a certain way. And now maybe I can't use it somewhere else. So I start to think about the open source intelligence world, because this is a risk in like software licenses and things like that, in the U.S. government contracting world that I live in. If I do something for the U.S. government, say I'm one of these, like an open source data gathering, M&A, or, you know, it's like these guys who sort of, you know, investigate companies, things like that, and I give something to the government, then they mark it a certain way, or they otherwise make it classified, are you now then hurting my ability commercially to use the data with other folks? So I don't know if this is a real risk or not, but I do have my ears up about it, because there's always a risk of overclassification in the government. And we've certainly seen more often than not, the risk is to overmark something. And then if I'm private industry and I go, I gathered that and I gave it to you, like under a license or a contract, and then I find out you're marking it, are you now stopping me from freely distributing it to other subscribers? Possibility.
You know, I guess it's a theoretical possibility. I also think that the government, especially over the course of the Biden administration, is learning to, I guess, enjoy using openly acquired intelligence offensively, I guess, if you will, both with respect to Russia and then also with China. I'm not sure sort of at the outset whether that's a problem. I think that it becomes an issue when, for instance, if, you know, CIA and DIA, both of which are sort of all source agencies, are marrying that openly acquired information with information that's acquired clandestinely, then obviously you start very quickly going up the classification ladder. But I also think that especially if there is a diplomatic or other purpose, that having a requisite amount of open source data from which to write an analytical piece on, and then to distribute that outside of sort of the U.S., the Five Eyes, or other, you know, allied governments, I think is an incredible tool for us to have diplomatically. And I think it's proven that. I mean, it's certainly in the Ukraine context.
Probably one last question for you, Tim. What are your views on maybe institutionalizing open source intelligence, right? Like, I'm aware there was like an open source intelligence center, which I think was CIA run, but is there a place where this would fit among the EIC today with an existing agency, or should there be like its own thing, right? That all agencies are using a single location or center or whatever?
So you know, there's a cultural bias in the IC for information that is acquired clandestinely, and sort of, and frankly, a, you know, a pecking order that sort of prioritizes and privileges those who do the acquiring of information clandestinely. And because of that, I have believed since I sort of started getting exposed to the issue that it ought to be, if not its own agency, certainly have enough institutional heft that it doesn't just get drowned out and subsumed by everybody else. And whether or not that is sort of to beef up whatever open source enterprise, you know, exists out now, you know, ODNI, or whether you want to stand up something altogether on its own, is up to people who frankly are bureaucratically more intelligent than I am, because I've seen arguments for both. And I'm not sure what the right answer is, but I do know that this is an incredibly rich source of information that can help make us safer, that can help give the president and other national leaders even more decision advantage when they're going into negotiations with foreign governments, whether it's on, you know, arms control or trade or whatever, and that we need to be doing whatever we can to maximize it, because it's out there and it's freely available, because the Chinese are doing it, and they're doing it incredibly aggressively.
So it sounds like, yeah, open source intelligence is, I think you said, it's a rich seam of information here that needs to be mined. Perhaps failure to grab that means we left behind. I mean, if information that's out there like this is in the hands of others, I also kind of feel like for parts of this, if private industry has better information than the IC community, you're kind of missing this opportunity. And your point's well taken that perhaps this is something that needs to have the strength to sort of survive on its own. I don't know where it should fit or where it would go, but I also agree with your comment that I think there is, based on my own experience in the defense world, there is, of course, a pecking order with information that has been gathered through national technical means or other clandestine ways that's then classified. There's a high verity of its trust, and it's where it's come from, but you know, don't discount the open source stuff out there. And more so now, it sounds like there's a lot of great information that's out there that wouldn't be accessible 20 years ago. So I think this is an area we're going to come back to again. But Tim, any other final words?
No, I mean, I'll just say this. Take, for example, the, you know, North Korean military parades. I mean, we learn an awful lot from viewing those videos, all of which are produced by the North Korean government and broadcast on TV and put on the internet. So that's an example where our best ability to kind of get up close and personal, if you will, with North Korean hardware is via KCNA. So, you know, with that, I guess I'll just leave it. Have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend, Sam.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.